Welcome to Marketing Musicology with your host, Dr. David Allen.
Welcome to Marketing Musicology. Today we're talking with Steve Culler. Known Steve forever and knew about him forever and had the pleasure of getting to know him better over the last couple of months. Steve, now at Pandora with a cool title, and I'm going to let him give you that title.
All right. Thank you. It's a Sonic Strategy Director for Studio Resonate at Pandora, it's an exciting time for me as a self-described audio alchemist, kind of blending science and art at a service that continues to grow, expand, but is probably most known for its music genome and its early entry into the streaming market. So it's wonderful to be there, be surrounded by really creative individuals, as well as a team of scientists and musicologists. And music lovers. I'm like a kid in a candy store.
Tell us how you got to this point in your life at Pandora.
Actually, my life now is a convergence of three different life passions. So the first is psychology. That's what my major and degree is in, and the second is music, and music has always been a part of my life. I started taking piano lessons when I was a six-year-old, eventually picked up a guitar in junior high, started writing songs in high school, mainly because I found it was a fairly effective dating tool, but I never thought about it as a career, so I graduated from high school, went to university, studied psychology, graduated with my bachelor's, and the plan was to go on and work on a master's and then a PhD either in social psychology or on the more clinical side. So I was sitting out for a year working. One of my gigs was doing research and statistics for a community mental health board, and the other was teaching kids with severe behavioral disorders. And I was continuing to play music on the weekends in coffee houses. And there was never a real aha moment. I think I just gave myself permission to consider something different and wound up taking a detour. Instead of heading to grad school, I went south to Nashville and pursued the music business. Found out very quickly that there were much better writers, much better musicians, much better vocalists than I was, but I had a knack for production, and in a weird twist of fate, happening to be at the right place at the right time, I started doing dance remixes of, believe it or not, country songs. And actually did a remix for a new artist at the time named Tim McGraw, and that kind of launched my career there. Music Row in Nashville, worked for all the major labels, did a ton of remixes, and around that time started exploring music and advertising, and that brings me to my third passion. I found that not only did I enjoy writing and producing music for commercials, I found that I just really loved marketing, branding, and advertising. I had a knack for writing copy, actually started getting into brand management. And in 2005, all of these passions collided when I stumbled upon this thing called audio branding. And in researching it, found that there was a lot of really interesting work going on in Europe. And so that's where I kind of concentrated my focus. Eventually opened another shop in Germany, And so had an office in Nashville, office in Frankfurt, had my own company, IB. The company in Germany was IB2 that I launched with a partner, Uli Ries. For the last 15 years, have been building that company, did a lot of work for brands, and in the process of some work for Pandora, just found I really loved the folks at Pandora. We got along really well, and one day just woke up and decided we should put a ring on it. So they hired me, as I said, as a Sonic Strategy Director. So I'm closing down my own companies and moving forward with Pandora, doing everything that I've done in the past, but on steroids. So that was a bit meandering, but as short as I could make it for you.
You know, you bring up the whole Europe thing, and maybe you can tell me you agree with me or disagree with me, but does it seem like audio respected more outside of the United States in some fashion, or it's looked at much more, not academically, but as an artifact, as opposed to it feels like it's more commercial in the United States and just looked at as sort of a tactic, not a strategy. And in Europe, it really feels like it's ingrained in branding and all that kind of stuff. Or am I just down on America?
I would actually use the word academic because I think, you know, we could talk about the whys, which, you know, I don't really know what I would, ascribe it to, other than the fact that, you know, we're dealing in Europe and even in the UK with much older cultures that have a different kind of relationship with the arts and the development of the arts, and I think also with design. So I think that there's a way in which European cultures have had a more academic approach. And kind of bridging into the cognitive sciences and how music science, if you will, might be a subset of cognitive sciences, certainly of design and design thinking. And I think that's provided some opportunities to really study music and sound from the standpoint of physics, and psychophysics, and even behavioral economics. And I think that that is starting to catch on in the U.S., partly driven by this kind of resurgence of interest in audio. We can talk more about what that's about. But I do think that, practically speaking, in the U.S., the bad habits that we've developed really are around thinking about sound purely as a tactic rather than thinking about it as a strategy. And look, I think that particularly in the worlds of advertising and marketing, that's a universal problem. So I will say that even though I have had a lot more interesting conversations with my colleagues on audio branding and sonic identity that are based in Europe, where there's a much richer heritage here, we all would tell you that when it comes to brands and marketing and advertising, this idea of only thinking tactically is a universal problem. So, you know, while sonic identity or sonic branding or as a discipline may be more developed in Europe, and we're seeing it emerge a lot more here in the U.S., this problem of tactic versus strategy is a universal problem that all of us have been trying to change that conversation for years, and and you know as much about that as I do.
When I'm asked to quote on this or speak on this, that it's not about the logo. That's just one of the parts. And that's unfortunately where people may start and end, which shows they just think of it as a tactic and not a strategy. But I to get to the, you know, the resurgence of audio, the good thing about whether that's real or not, the good thing about it is that I think it's getting a lot more attention now because it's getting a lot more respect. And with that comes, I think, more of the European appreciation for it in the United States. So I welcome that. I laugh when people say audio's back, and I go, well, audio never went away.
Right.
And I think it's just because, you know, better people like yourself are diving into it with companies that are giving you the ability to sort of expand it out, whereas you had this ability with your company especially to do this outside of the United States well before now. So I think all good, all ships rise in this case, and if there's a resurgence, then I'm all for it. It certainly gives me more to talk about, to research and that kind of stuff. But, you know, in academia, publishing studies on music and advertising or music and retail, while I was on the way up, the American journals would not publish my research. I'd have to go outside the United States to get journals to publish the research because it was, looked at as too pop culture, too soft, to something. And even that's changing better now that I don't need the publications anymore, and I'm helping people get publications. Now they're getting published with stuff that I couldn't get published with years ago. So it's all good.
Yeah, I think, to that point, there has been an interesting intersection between the academic and the practical application, which is, really at the heart of my concept of the audio alchemist, that really draws on this idea of science and academia. I appreciate the rigors of empirical research. I'm very sensitive to a lot of marketing research that probably doesn't use the strongest methodology, and certainly in advertising and marketing, there's a lot of appeal to either junk science or basing entire systems on one piece of research. So I appreciate the academic rigors, but at the same time, I do know that in marketing and advertising, there's this other side of it, which is the art, and maybe even performance art, if you will. And there's always a tension between the pure art on the one side of the coin, and I use that metaphor intentionally because I don't think these are opposite ends of a pole. I think they're both the same coin, just two sides. But the emphasis on performance and art on the one side, and pure research and science on the other, and so we're always trying to find that tension. And I think that academic journals have been influenced enough by business applications to recognize the worth of translating some of this knowledge into something that's useful for the purposes of business. And on the other side of it, I think there are more and more of us who appreciate the rigors who are attempting to bring that into the world of marketing and advertising, and kind of blow the whistle on occasion when we need to, even with our own companies, to be able to say, I'm not so sure you could interpret the data exactly that way, or here's another methodology that could be stronger. And I think that physics, which I was pulled into through kind of becoming a satellite in the world of Charles Spence, the head of the Crossmodal Research Laboratory at Oxford, and doing a lot of work around our senses and food and particularly hearing and sound and how that can shape our perception of taste and flavor. And that's been hugely fun, hugely artistic, hugely creative, and bringing some of this the science of psychophysics into the brand world and working with brands like Chevis or Cadbury or Propel on ways to build experiential events around brands that are tied into this science base. And again, I've found in Europe, and particularly in the UK, when it comes to multi-sensory techniques, they're much further down the road than we are here in the U.S., but I'm seeing very quickly the U.S. kind of get excited about these kinds of things, adopting the techniques, and being open to the research, and actually giving, some money and a budget to doing that kind of research that's great for the brand, but also adds to the academic knowledge base for journal publications. And I think that's just really, really healthy. So I'm going to stop there because I keep giving, I'm passionate about all these things, so I can very quickly jump up on the soapbox and not give anybody a breath.
No, the beautiful thing about talking to you is that you ask and answer the question that I'm just going to ask and ask next. So I don't I just need to get you started and then on down a train and you take it from there. So what gets you excited right now, other than experiential and sensory and that kind of stuff? Like what things are you looking? What can we be looking for in sonic branding and in the next couple of months, looking forward, do you think?
Well, I think, I'm one of these guys that's always trying to look at how do we push the envelope, particularly around thinking and strategy. I'm full of little sound bites and quips, and one that I use quite often is that, sonic identity doesn't start with our ears. It starts with what's between them. And you had mentioned earlier on in the conversation how when we talk about sonic identity, very quickly brands and advertising agencies jump to the execution. Oh, it's that thing I hear. Oh, it's the audio logo or a brand theme or a jingle or a functional sound. And these are all tactical executions that certainly are an aspect of sonic identity and sonic branding. But I'm more intrigued with what are the choices that go into, or what's the strategy or the thinking that goes into the choices for why would I choose those particular sounds? Why would I choose that particular voiceover? What is the methodology behind the design? So the things that I'm interested in right now and trying to push the envelope on my side more is what can we borrow from the world of behavioral economics and looking at perception and consumer insights? How can that inform the work that we're doing? What are some techniques and methodologies that are aligned not only with design thinking, but with behavioral psychology and experience and some of these other worlds like psychophysics as well as psychoacoustics. And how do we view this as a system? So again, rather than just an audio asset, what's the system? And then finally, from a research perspective, how are we measuring outcomes? Can we, or maybe the question is also should we, attach KPIs to the use of audio in a brand context. What would those KPIs be? How would we measure those outcomes? And I'm definitely intrigued by this idea of audio ROI, if you will. And, you know, look, I think ROI has become a catchphrase that in some ways it's lost its meaning. I think a lot of CMOs and even CEOs who are talking about ROI are simply talking about risk management, not necessarily thinking about it, you know, in terms of a formula. But is there an approach where using econometric data as well as design strategies where we're attempting to build in consistencies and efficiencies, but still leaving the flexibility for artistic exploration and surprises along the way, is there a way we could even get predictive in understanding worth and costs? A simple aspect of that might be looking at what's the cost we might pay to license a piece of music if we were to think that would be a good strategy for a particular part of advertising or brand messaging. And, we're told, here's the cost of that license. Could we determine whether or not that would be an effective use of a brand budget, or would we be better off coming up with a bespoke piece of music or audio content that as a brand we might actually own that copyright? Or should we look for an even less expensive license for a piece of music that might be part of a library? And so understanding how to make these choices not only has an impact on the brand identity, but also has a direct impact on costs and bottom line. And those are the questions that I'm finding are most intriguing, and also are kind of piquing the interest of brands in particular, and not just CMOs, but CFOs in looking at some of these applications. So right now, that's kind of where my personal passions, beyond some of the psychology pieces, are taking me. These are certainly more around economic and business models.
Yeah, it's funny because the I'm thinking the same things. I'm delivering a paper at Columbia in December, I think, where it's a branding thing for Journal of Consumer Research, a pre-special issue conference, and some of the things that I talk about in there that people need to be thinking about, of course, ROA, I call it, return on audio. And then, what does Alexa say when you say your brand? It's audio engine optimization with smart speakers that, I don't know about you, but I use Alexa almost entirely at home to do many things. And there's just so much capacity for brands to be doing stuff on there that they're not. Surprisingly, I got, I was pretty out there on some of the stuff that I was writing about for the conference. And the person said, yeah, we'd love to have that. That was way out of, it was just a general branding kind of conference. So, again, I think audio is getting respect, new respect, which allows me, I guess, more opportunity to speak about it. The state of audio, talking to someone at Pandora, which, the next office over is Sirius XM, and you have an owner that owns a lot of radio debt from at least one radio company. The convergence of commercial audio, I'll call it, music, I guess, streaming, is it going to be owned by two or three people, and that there will be no real separation between a radio station, a streaming company, a satellite company, a chip in your head, I don't know, in
way above my
your pay grade.
But you know, I certainly think we're in an age where I think more and more of these distinctions between quote unquote digital and analog are becoming meaningless. You know, I mean, what is digital audio? What is satellite audio? What is terrestrial radio? I think those are, you know, perhaps points on a development timeline, but as delivery mechanisms continue to converge, you know, you mentioned Sirius, who you know, earlier this year bought Pandora, which is essentially a satellite radio station, but they're part of Liberty Media, which is a bigger conglomerate that also owns you know, ticketing for venues. So you bring that into the mix. And do I think that we'll continue to have, you know, monopolies? Certainly. I also think that technology is going to continue to be disruptive as well. I think we could very quickly go off the rails here if we start talking about the moral and ethical implications of all of this. But I do think at the end of the day, the playing fields have been somewhat level. And I think you're beginning to see this even in media and advertising, where sonic identity, for instance, is now become such a hot thing that I kind of, you know, I wouldn't say predicted, but had mentioned as part of a kind of a future thinking piece that I did for the Audio Branding Academy out of Hamburg, mentioned that one of the things that I saw coming down the road was that you were going to begin to see media companies getting involved in sonic identity. And this past year, we've seen the two major radio networks in Australia offering sonic identity services, one of them doing it in-house, the other partnering with CCM Sohn, a classic audio branding company that's been around for 20 years, based out of Paris. You now see Pandora getting into this world during Cannes Advertising Festival earlier in June. There was an announcement from iHeartRadio that they were partnering with WPP to offer Sonic Identity, Sonic Strategy services. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if very soon you see an announcement from VaynerMedia. I wouldn't be surprised if you see something from Spotify. And so even what's happening there is that's leveling this audio playing field, if you were away from specialized audio branding design companies, if you will, now into larger holding companies or media companies getting into this mix, data companies, you know, becoming part of the mix. So in testing and measuring, I mean, personally, I'm excited about that we're having much more rigorous measures and companies that are doing both explicit and implicit testing involved in developing some audio-only approaches. So on the one hand, I think all of that is good in elevating the conversation. On the other hand, I think the danger is we're creatures of habit and, you know, to come back to our earlier conversation about strategy and tactics, while we've elevated these conversations, and there's certainly more of them around the importance of sound, those old habits are hard to break. And so you're continuing to see brands and some of these companies that are jumping on the sonic identity, sonic strategy bandwagon still gravitate towards tactics. And still, how quickly can we get to the execution? And that that has the potential of, you know, really kind of being short-sighted, which again is where I think the more interesting conversations for me are around, you know, looking at long-term brand building techniques versus short-term sales activation, a la The Long and the Short of It by Les Panay and Peter Field. And some of these marketers and behavioral economists who are really causing us to, you know, ask questions about audio, which has tended to be viewed as a short-term sales activation tool, particularly in the audio-only worlds of radio and streaming, rather than as a long-term brand-building tool. You know, I think those discussions are giving us another framework, but I'm finding that I'm still continually needing to reframe the conversation around audio, even in, you know, a world where brands have finally woke up to the fact that, oh, yeah, no screen. Oh, no text. You're only hearing my brand. I guess it needs to sound like something, and not really knowing where to go on that journey.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that's helping, I guess, sort of reframe how companies will look at this. I think about this more and more as the smart speaker more so than the you know, the stereo speaker, because you can talk to it and it either responds or it doesn't respond, and it responds in a you know, maybe a pleasing sonic way, and hopefully that combined with the fact that it does look like the mergers and acquisitions that are happening are with the good guys taking over the bad guys, as opposed to just sort of, you know, a grab all for, okay, we don't have that in our portfolio, let's go get that. So I'm hopeful. Right. I'm hopeful in both cases that this will turn out good. Something. And I feel better knowing that someone like you is at the table leading the discussion in some fashion. So I want to thank you for being on Marketing Musicology. Thanks to our friend Steve Keller at Pandora.
Thank you so much, Steve, for having me. I appreciate, you know, not only the platform, but the fact that you're giving so many of us that are doing this work a voice to help move the conversation along. So thank you so much for doing that.
You've been listening to Marketing Musicology with Dr. David Allen.